Welcome to the Westminster Institute. I'm Robert Riley, its director. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back to the Westminster Institute a veteran speaker for us, and that's Dave DeRoche, who is associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies at National Defense University. Prior to his appointment at NDU, he was the Defense Department Director responsible for policy concerning Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. Before that, he served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as liaison to the Department of Homeland Security, as Senior Country Director for Pakistan, as NATO Operations Director, and as Deputy Director for Peacekeeping. An airborne ranger in the Army Reserve, Colonel DeRoche was awarded the Bronze Star for his service in Afghanistan. He has made 105 military parachute jumps. He was the first West Point graduate to have majored in Arabic studies. He has commanded conventional and special operations parachute units and has served on the U.S. Special Operations Command staff as well as on the Joint Staff. He's also obtained advanced degrees in Arab politics from the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies, in war studies from King's College, London, and strategic studies from the U.S. Army War College. He is the author of Dominance versus Disruption, Asymmetry in Gulf Security. Dave has previously spoken at Westminster on the subjects of the push and pull of religious extremism. Who are the terrorists? How are they recruited? What can we do? And more recently, on the ongoing war in the Persian Gulf, why does it matter to the U.S.? Today, he will address the subject of ISIS, from near state to persistent problem. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, thanks. It's always an honor to be with the Westminster Institute, even virtually, I can feel the love through the camera. So hopefully I'll provide a diverting moment of time, and I know that our interlocutor here will challenge me with questions. So first I want to show you all my contact information. I tweet and blog a lot of things that'll be of interest. Very few of it is my own. Usually it's things that are sent to me by other people. Currently, I've leaned towards heavy analysis of the Ukrainian-Russian war. So ISIS, Daesh, as those of us who know Arabic refer to it, the Islamic State was a truly unprecedented phenomenon. It was a non-state actor that managed to acquire most of the trappings of a state. It controlled land on two sides of an international border, the hated Sykes-Picot dividing line between Iraq and Syria, which they, with great flourish, demolished, thus saying, you know, we've eliminated the legacy of colonialism. They managed to inspire followers and fighters all around the world. And they've also managed to attract affiliates, which even while they have gone underground in their heartland of the Sunni regions spanning the border between Iraq and Syria, we find in places like the Philippines, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Indonesia, North Africa, Central Africa, as well as lone wolf terrorist attacks in Europe, the United States. You know, they continue to inspire. So they form a phenomena that has global impact that threatens the security of the United States and its partners, and that still seeks to overthrow the world order. So at its height, it controlled a great amount of territory. That was 2014, 2015. What you basically saw were the eastern parts of Syria under Bashar al-Assad was ungoverned. Assad had focused his security forces together with those of his protectors from Iran and Russia and proxies brought in under Iranian leadership from Lebanon, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere, and Iraq, They had focused on the line running north-south from the Turkish border to Aleppo, Hama, Homs, Damascus, and everything between that and the Mediterranean Sea. The east, for the most part, with the exception of Palmyra, was uncontested. And it actually served Bashar al-Assad's purposes to have the eastern part of Syria under the control of Daesh, because then he could characterize all opposition to his rule as ISIS, as global Islamic terrorists. And indeed, when Russia first intervened in Syria, they called for a resurrection of the global alliance that had defeated fascism in World War II. They called for that to be resurrected and to fight against Islamist terrorism, just as Russian forces today wear the colors of the victory ribbons for the World War II battle in Ukraine. They did the same thing when they entered into ISIS. On the eastern side of the border in Iraq, what we saw was ISIS manifested itself primarily in Sunni-controlled areas. With the withdrawal of U.S. forces in 2011, the Iraqi prime minister very quickly purged the ranks. As a matter of fact, as the last U.S. convoy crossed the border into Kuwait, purged the ranks of Sunni officials and converted the Iraqi government into an arm of his al-Dawa party, which great portions of which fell under the influence of the Iranian government. And as a government, it devoted itself not so much to providing services, but rather to advancing the agenda of the traditionally oppressed Shia of Iraq. This obviously didn't set well in the Sunni areas. And you recall the initial massacres and advances of ISIS, you know, the hundreds of soldiers being marched off to Camp Spiker, where they were executed. Shia senior officers in Mosul and places east of that abandoning their post, making haste to Baghdad and leaving their soldiers to be massacred. This, you know, reflected in large part the development, particularly of foreign fighter cadres within ISIS, but it also reflected the fact that the civilian population, predominantly Sunni, did not support the government and was happy for anything that could represent the interests of Sunni Islam against the hated and often Iranian-led Iraqi government, which had been captured by Shia political movements. So over time, as we see in this chart, we can see how the territory under the control of ISIS has shrunk. The United States and coalition partners were invited back into Iraq without any invitation, took action in Syria after the execution of American and British hostages, and began to support the Iraqi government, primarily through the counterterrorism services, and then stood up, or at least enabled, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which primarily is Kurdish leadership. And that group, which is multinational, but again, the core of it is Kurdish, began conquering ISIS-held territory in Syria. That's led us to a situation that we see today, which is one that's kind of unusual in that you have a vestigial coalition presence in the north of and the east of Syria, a U.S.-led coalition allied with primarily Kurdish forces, although not exclusively Kurdish forces, and then a small area on the border with Jordan around El Tanf, where again you have anti-Bashar al-Assad forces that are allied with U.S. forces. The rest of the country is controlled by Syria and its proxies, you know, its Russian and Lebanese Hezbollah allies. And then we see occasional raids from ISIS dead-enders who have managed to remain in the Syrian desert or in Iraq. And there still is a significant number of them, but again, they don't control land. So they're basically, they've moved from a near state to a terrorist organization. The first leader of ISIS, of course, was al-Baghdadi. Al-Baghdadi was an interesting figure, charismatic one. His Islamic credentials of Egypt, of Islamic scholarship, were legit. He was a graduate in theology from a respected Iraqi university. His official pronouncements had decent scholarship. It was basically, he knew his references. Of course, he called for the establishment of a caliphate, which meant an Islamic state, under terms that brooked no dissent. Basically, he declared that he was enacting the will of God in enacting the state, and that all true Muslims were to either join him, make hijrah, and fight under his army, or to support him remotely. And if you didn't do that, then you were either guilty of apostasy, or you were a pagan, or one of the peoples of the books, Jews or Christians, who should be subjugated to the true rule of Islam as embodied in al-Baghdadi's Islamic State. But you would not be accorded full rights. This was a call for global revolution and global dominance. And in areas where there were substantial disaffected Islamic populations, areas with ineffective government, like the states of the Sahel, which are among the poorest and most corrupt in the world, this call to arms was very, very, very effective and welcome, in large part because these local movements were seeking a coherent global framework with which, quite frankly, to scare the hell out of government forces. So what we saw were, after the establishment of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, we saw the pledging of affiliate statuses to numerous organizations in failing or risk of failing states. So Mali was almost taken over by an Islamic State affiliate. We've seen violence by Islamic State affiliates throughout the Sahel, most notably the killing of several US soldiers in Niger, which led to many Americans to first try to find Niger on a map, and second questioning the government as to what on earth we were doing with soldiers in a place so remote and isolated. We saw in the chaos of Libya, an Islamic State affiliate rise and for a brief moment seize places of ground and conducting a rather gruesome visual execution of Egyptian cops who had been working in Libya. In the Sinai Peninsula, the militants there pledged allegiance to Daesh and engaged in a years-long battle with the Egyptian security forces, which appears to have been suppressed in large part because of Egyptians enlisting the nomadic tribes in the Sinai in their cause. In the Philippines, of course in Afghanistan, and possibly in the other republics of Central Asia. Al-Baghdadi eventually, following the collapse of the Islamic State and the sustained military campaign to reduce its strongholds in Mosul in Iraq and then finally Raqqa in Syria, became basically a refugee in his own country, hiding out in a safe house where he was eventually tracked down by U.S. forces and blew himself up prior to capture. He was replaced by Emir Muhammad Said Abdulrahman al-Mawla, known as Haji Abdullah. He was very much an interim leader. He didn't have the same credentials of Islamic scholarship. He was basically a man who was available, a person who knew the organization, but didn't necessarily have the same cachet within the organization. And he was killed early this year in his safe house, which was in rebel-controlled parts of Syria, again by U.S. forces. Unfortunately, the location of this was capitalized on by Bashar al-Assad as well as his Russian patrons as saying, you see, everybody who fights the Assad regime is Daesh. After his death, he was replaced by a new leader known as Abu al-Hassan al-Hashimi al-Qureshi. The al-Hashimi al-Qureshi is a tribal designation. The Qureshi means that he's a descendant of the Prophet. We're not sure if that's true or not. We're not quite sure who he is. We're not quite sure what he is, because given the past track record, you don't want to provide too much biographical information on yourself if you're the leader of Daesh. But the provinces of ISIS, in the Sahel, in the Sinai, and elsewhere, have pledged their allegiance to him. My most credible guess, based on people who know, is that in actuality he's Juma Awad al-Badri, who's the older brother of al-Baghdadi, the first caliph of Daesh. Regardless of who he is, he presides over an organization which has lost little of its fervor but much of its capability, and still remains a profound security challenge, not just in Iraq and Syria, but also to the West. Let me go into a little bit of theology here now and the nature of jihad to kind of explain how the organization has changed. So in Daesh theology, there's two types of jihad. The first is called jihad al-tamkin. Jihad is a loaded word in Western political discourse or in analysis of it. There have been some people who, taken literally, it means the and as used by ISIS leaders, it means the campaign to extend the rule of Islam and to subjugate all those who oppose it. But it can also mean, and apologists for not necessarily Daesh, but practitioners of a more quietist form of Islam say it actually refers to the inner struggle to refine oneself, make oneself a better person. Asking people, what the definition of jihad is, it's often used as a litmus test to say, okay, are you easy or soft on Islam, or are you awakened? And some view this as an incipient threat that needs to be confronted, and if you don't understand the difference, then you're likely to be sucked in and reduced to a position of subservience to triumphalist Islam. But in the Daesh usage, the ISIS usage, jihad is conquer. Full-on militarist. Jihad al-Tamkin refers to the form of jihad in government. Once you're in government, once you're in power, how you use your power to advance the rule of Islam and to glorify Islam as interpreted by ISIS and by ISIS doctrine. And so this refers to making literally the example of the Prophet as literally stated out in the Quran or as reported by others in the Hadith, the words of the Prophet, and interpreted by religious scholars that ISIS takes its cues from, which is not the entire body of Islamist religious scholars, but rather a select audience, to implement the world as Islam requires it, according to Daesh's lights. So we saw this took place in a number of areas, and indeed, some of these things, like the prohibition against corruption, was welcomed by some of the population under Daesh that had been used to rapacious, ethnically dissimilar officials of the Iraqi government, particularly moving in and extracting petty bribes at every occasion. But what you saw are things, for example, campaigns against drug smugglers and drug usage and drug taking, the impetus to try to coin money, which is actually a duty of a government under this interpretation of Islam. All of these were advanced, and the Daesh did not neglect services. There were trash collection, the normal functions of government, justice being written out according to Islamic principles. Of course, large parts of this conflict with the modern world, executions, amputation of limbs for theft, things of those nature, things which we feel have no place in the modern world, did have a place in ISIS. And that, of course, led to a lot of conflict. And there were also, mistreatment of prisoners or people who were not members of, did not practice Islam according to the precepts of ISIS. So, but that form of jihad was the focus of ISIS while it controlled large parts of Iraq and Syria. Since ISIS has been defeated militarily, they've shifted to the second form of jihad, jihad al-Niqaya, which is the jihad when you're out of power. It means to confound the powers which, in their ideology, lacks the legitimacy conferred by their interpretation of Islam. And so this refers to things such as attacks on government facilities, attacks on banks, the use of car bombs, taking of hostages and sometimes executing them, and more importantly, raids on prisons. And we've seen a lot of this, both because it's the precept of the jihad al-Niqaya, as well as because it's just a tactical necessity. So what has happened in military terms is Daesh has gone from being a near state to reverting to a low-level insurgency stroke terrorist organization. They're not controlling land. They're incapable of controlling land for large periods of time, so they don't attempt to do the functions of government, but rather they do the functions to subvert the existing government, to undermine its legitimacy, and in some instances, things like conducting marriages or something like that, among the faithful, to take over some of those functions to sap the legitimacy of the government and eventually supplant it. So they've moved back to an earlier stage of insurgency, stroke terrorism. This would be familiar to anybody who's studied guerrilla movements. You know, if you look at Che Guevara, it's kind of the same thing where you try to undermine the government and then eventually supplant it with your own ideology as the guiding precepts rather than the one that you had before. And that's where we are now. So we've moved back to the early days of the insurgency. They're looking more like Al-Qaeda and less like the Islamic State that we saw that, you know, collected customs duties and erected its own, erased the border between Iraq and Syria. So where is ISIS today? Well, they're really lost a lot of personnel numbers. Estimates are that they have between 6 and 10,000 fighters. I'm talking about in Syria and Iraq. The other movements are affiliates. There's no real control, and there's no evidence of mutual support among these movements. There is a possibility that they draw from the same funders, which are scattered all over the world. But in Iraq and Syria, you have 6 to 10,000. This is a significant number of people. This is a number of fighters who, if they want to, can mass at unexpected locations and overwhelm government facilities for a small amount. So they will continue to carry out lethal attacks for the foreseeable future. And these lethal attacks, you know, have the ability to overwhelm the Syrian Iraqi coalition forces in some places. There are over 10,000 ISIS personnel that are being held in prisons, mostly run by the Syrian Democratic Forces. Some of these, El Sinai prison has 3,500 of them, of whom 700 are children, the so-called cubs of the caliphate. These pose a real problem for governments because you have children who have been thoroughly indoctrinated, who are in a horrible position where, quite frankly, they probably are either being preyed on by the most ideologically committed members of Daesh, or they're being indoctrinated into themselves becoming ideologically committed. And they're being held in conditions that, quite frankly, are inhumane. And what we're finding is that many of the foreign fighters are included in these numbers as well. And some of these foreign fighters come from Western democracies who, quite frankly, don't want them back because they know that they are likely to pose a security challenge, but they don't have the legal tools within the framework of a modern liberal democracy to effectively prevent these people from committing acts of violence. They would either have to be watched on a full-term basis, which, you know, requires about 100 police officers around, you know, over the course of a year to keep a person under continuous surveillance. You need about 100 police officers. That's prohibitive. They can't be incarcerated because modern Western liberal justice doesn't allow you to do that. We've seen the ineffectiveness of de-radicalization programs, most notably the London Bridge attacks, where a person who was graduating from a de-radicalization program turned and murdered his supposed mentor in that program. So this is a problem. And quite frankly, it exposes a lot of hypocrisy on the part of Western countries that have spent years criticizing the United States for things like Guantanamo Bay. Informally, some of these government officials, when approached about the need to take back their citizens, have said, well, could you move them to Guantanamo Bay? The other problem we have is, you know, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which again are predominantly Kurdish, you know, they're wondering how long do we have to keep these people because it is a security burden, it's very expensive, and they're aware that this is a ticking time bomb. As we can see, you know, some of the children in these camps, particularly the Al-Hol camp, which is just horrendous, it's huge. There have been shootings, there have been murders, there have been attacks, there's evidence of extortion, of ethnic violence, of violence by Islamic State hardliners against those who, you know, wish to move away from it, and indoctrination of children. But it's one of those situations where people are just kind of turning their eyes away and hoping that the situation will resolve itself somehow, that it will just go away. It is too hard for countries to deal with. There are some people, foreign fighters from places like Uyghurs, who, quite frankly, it would be a gross injustice for them to be returned to China. They will be executed on arrival. There are others from Central Asia who know they're in it for the long run. And then, of course, we have the ones from Western countries, much smaller in numbers, but serious problems. And, you know, a number of them are being handed over to the Iraqi criminal justice system if they are of Iraqi nationality. That creates its own problems. We have seen a few small instances of citizens being returned to Western democracies. And just this week, we saw the trial of one of the surviving members of the so-called Beatles, the four ISIS members with British citizenship or British residency who were involved in the torture of Western hostages while ISIS was at its ascendancy. But make no doubt, this is an incubator of radicalism. This is a problem, and it's not going to get better. And what we saw just before the Ukraine war pushed everything out off the face of it was we saw an attack on one of these prisons where ISIS went and freed hundreds of hardened fighters to replenish its ranks. We can expect a lot more of this in the future. The second problem that ISIS continues to pose, and bear in mind there are already 6 to 10,000 hardened fighters. So the second problem is with 6 to 10,000 hardened fighters, if you're going to stop them from causing problems, you need to have effective governance. That's the only way to neutralize them. But in Syria and Iraq, we do not see effective governance. In the areas that have defeated ISIS militarily, those are now primarily controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces, which, as I said earlier, are primarily Kurdish. This is not a recipe for success. I mean, what we have are Arab parts of the world that are controlled in large part by a Kurdish-led force. And eventually there will be, you know, Arab resentment over rule by a different ethnicity will eventually manifest itself in conflict. Maybe not outright people joining ISIS, but passive support is really all you need when you have such a large volume of that. You know, just an unwillingness to contact the security forces to counter ISIS movement. Similarly, on the Iraqi side of the border, it looks as though Muqtada Sadr, who is a Shia cleric, got the largest number of votes in the most recent Iraqi election. And when he forms a government after about a year in the Iraqi function, it's quite likely that it's quite possible that this government will again not be effective at representing the interests of Sunni citizens, but rather will be simply a manifestation of Shia superiority in Sunni areas. And if that is the case, we could expect support, active and passive, for the predominantly, or the overwhelmingly Sunni ISIS and its 6 to 10,000 fighters to rise. So insurgency theory tells us that when you have poor government services and an unrepresentative government, those are the conditions that are ripe for insurgency. So will ISIS again control an area the size of Texas and both sides of the international border? Probably not. But will ISIS continue to be an active security threat to Iraq, to Syria, and to global security interests? Will it continue to inspire foreign attacks in the West? The answer, I think, to that is undoubtedly yes. And quite frankly, I think that the nations of the world have taken a vacation from the history of ISIS. But ISIS is not defeated. It's merely dormant. And it's something that perhaps we should focus our attention on again. And I think that's it, Bob. Is that okay?
Dave, thank you very much. Let me ask you a question, since you touched upon Islamic theology a bit. Islam is the religion of success, not only in that its adherents are promised paradise if they follow the ways of the Prophet and the Quran and Hadith, but success in this world as well, which if they don't have, can potentially point them to the fact that they may not be on that path. Now, that's one of the arguments that groups like ISIS have used. However, they've been crushed. Now, has that lack of success, has their military defeat, do you know, caused any kind of internal convulsions in the ideological sense where they begin to question their own legitimacy?
Well, so there's such a large body of Islamic thought that there's a larger body of, because of the Hadith of the Prophet, there is, more Islamic theological sources than there are Christian theological sources. You have to start getting into medieval commentary to approach that same volume. Basically, any position can be argued or disargued from a position of authority, and then you argue over the strength of the hadiths and things of that nature. I think there has been a discussion as to what's happening, but I think that, quite frankly, the defeat of Islam, or rather of the Islamic State, fits in perfectly. And I have to tell you that my friends in Saudi Arabia and all that would say the so-called Islamic State. And I think that is a key. I think that, almost everybody rejects this formulation. So the defeat of Daesh does fit in with it because, as with most defeated movements that have a strong ideological component, they attribute it to treachery and they attribute it to departing from the true path. And this is a constant theme. If you read Jerry Falwell's speeches from the 70s, if the fall of Vietnam, if you read Meyer Kahane's exhortations before the 1967 war, the various founders of the settlement movement in Israel, or if you read the Ayatollah Khomeini, the themes are always the same. We are once a great people. Our legacy is that we control, our area, our lands, the area around our lands, or even the world. Our legacy is that we control something. We don't control it. Why is that? Because we've departed from the original, usually divine, handed down guidance. We've neglected the true path, and we've allowed traitors and people who are apostates to prosper in our midst and to mislead us from the true path. That's universal among all of these fundamentalist movements. It's a universal thing, and I think we're seeing it in Daesh as well.
Now, when they did have the Islamic State, of course, it was a huge magnet for, as you pointed out, foreign fighters, including those from the West, but also from other Muslim countries, that here at last is this caliphate of which we've dreamed and which we used to have. Even though there's now the third caliph of the Islamic State, as you pointed out, they don't really have a state or a home. So that had to considerably erode their attraction to both foreign fighters, or is it just a matter that there's no place for these people to go if they are attracted?
Good question. So, among radical Islamist thought, there's two schools. There's the Al-Qaeda school and the Daesh school. And in 2014, when Daesh was, having all these incredible battlefield victories, it appeared as, a couple things happened. Osama bin Laden, of course, he was a charismatic figure. He was dead. The main Al-Qaeda movement, the guys living on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, all the original leadership of that had been killed or died out. And the people who took them over were Egyptians. They were basically, the leadership is the people who led the sort of Egyptian Gamma Islamiyah in the 1990s. And they are not charismatic. They are dogmatic. They have very limited appeal. They don't have any star power. So, folks that were of a Muslim background who were dissatisfied with the world order in their country, and very few of these people lived in Muslim states. They lived in Muslim majority secular states. They saw their needs were not being met. If you tended to look towards Islam, radical interpretations of Islam as a solution to your properties, the more attractive option was Daesh, not Al-Qaeda. So they tended to affiliate with Al-Qaeda. And you saw this in Somalia. The Al-Shabaab in Somalia, they're going to fight who's ever in charge, provided as long as they're not in charge. It's kind of like a franchise. You want to have a re or a hotel, that one day it's Hyatt and then the next day it's Marriott. You pick the franchise that you think can help you achieve your goals, but the hotel's kind of the same. It's not like they burn all the beds and get new beds in. What we've seen with Daesh, the big thing that made the difference was Daesh declared the caliphate. Osama bin Laden said, "We won't do that because we, feel it's premature, Daesh did that. And a lot of people who, you know, were wavering between the two said, okay, that's the way to go. And look, they've done it. So now what you see is that the majority of that, you know, these affiliates have pledged their name to Daesh, but it's not because they so much believe that they're a province of a global caliphate as that they've allied with a brand that scares the hell out of people the most, that allows them to engage in negotiations with the government from a position of strength, things like that. And paradoxically, the place where it now looks like they're gaining ground most quickly is like Eastern Mali, Western Niger, Burkina Faso, eight places that in the past had been marginal to the struggle.
But the Islamic State had a very sophisticated communications strategy and implementation, slick online magazines, videos, and so forth. Now, that's been substantially degraded also, has it not? And would that also help contribute to a weakening of the appeal?
Yeah, so the Islamic State was producing glossy magazines in English and other languages. They were producing videos in English and other languages. You recall there was a video with a bunch of foreign fighters masked, speaking colloquial English of, you know, Australian and American English dialect, showing their passports and burning them at the height of Daesh. A lot of that has fallen off. We still see videos from, you know, making their way out there. The foreign language recruiting stuff seems to have died down just because it's getting harder and harder to do. I think that's a function of the degraded organization, not a function of degraded desire. I think that if they are able to reconstitute themselves, we'll see that again.
Now, you spoke in a very humorous way of different franchises. You can go from Hilton to another brand of hotel. But these franchises are in competition with each other. Yeah. And in the hotel world, that's easy to explain. One, they want to make profit and have more territory. But how would you characterize the antagonism between Islamic State and the other competing radical Islamist ideologies?
Yeah, boy, that's a good question, yeah. So the Islamic State theology is so absolute that if you disagree with it, you are an apostate. And in that interpretation of Islam, the penalty for apostasy is death, full stop. And what really caught my attention in one of the issues of Dabiq, the Islamic State magazine, there was an article written by a Finnish convert to Islam who, I can understand why this person was so radical, because it was 2015, I guess, so Ramadan was in the summer. So if you're in Helsinki and you're a practicing Muslim, you have to fast for like 22 hours a day. Yeah. The whole article was on nullifiers, this concept of nullifiers, which I think is critical to providing the Islamist framework for horrible actions taken supposedly in the names of religion. And the idea was that, you know, you can fast, you can give, you can make the zakat, you can, you know, pray five times a day. But if you are friends with a pagan, that is a nullifier, that there's one action you can take and that will render all of your other components of Islamic life null and void and make you the same, not just, you know, it makes you an apostate or a pagan, both of which are, you know, have no standing in the Daesh theology view of the world. So what we've seen, you know, we've seen fighting between the Taliban and Islamic State in Afghanistan, and that's because both sides believe the others to be apostates. And as we know, you know, when you look at religious warfare, it's bad between believers and unbelievers, but it's really bad between different flavors of believers who believe the other believer is doing it wrong. You know, I mean, look at the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, you know, something like that. That's when it gets really, really brutal. And that's kind of what we're seeing between Daesh and the different factions that are jockeying for it. So yeah, it's not strictly a commercial. It's It's not a choice of brand, but it's important to note that in places like West Africa, Libya, although they're kind of out of the ball game now, but Sinai, Somalia, Daesh, and Al Qaeda is not really able to enforce its will. It's locals making decisions, saying which brand, which theology do we want to be associated with.
But it's particularly ironic in Afghanistan that they have an Islamic emirate back in the saddle there, and then in Khorasan, the Daesh people are fighting them. What is, I understand, one considers themselves purer than the other, but sort of on what basis do they?
Okay, good question. So Khorasan refers to Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. So it's bigger than that. And so one of the primary nullifiers of Taliban legitimacy in the eyes of Daesh is the Taliban accommodation with Pakistan, which is a corrupt, and in their view, apostate government that also has the ability to, that has a nuclear capability. So it could theoretically be in the service, it could be a great conquering force in the service of the caliphate. But instead, the Taliban chooses to accommodate this government, which, has an army that it spends at least as much time securing commercial ventures for itself as it does defending the Pakistani state, and certainly has long ago abandoned the forced proselytization that Daesh sees as essential to Islam.
Dave, when you mentioned the nullifier effect, if you don't follow all of these things, you transgress one, you're no longer a Muslim, and
Even worse, you're an
you're an
apostate.
apostate, and therefore liable to be killed. This is, Islam has had experience of this kind of thing before. In fact, not too long after its inception, in the form of the Kharijites. The Khawaraj, you can pronounce that correctly for me.
Kharijite.
Kharijite, okay.
Yeah, if you want to get pretentious, it's
Thank you. Please do.
Kharijite.
Now, I've read contemporaneous reports of how the Kharijites behaved. And all you have to do is switch the weapons used, and it could be an account for exactly how some of the most radical modern Islamist groups behave today, including Daesh. It's a replication of it in a way. And they have the same ideology. You deviate in one way, and you're no longer a Muslim, and that's why they killed Ali. Now, let's just say the general strain of Islam found the Kharijites repugnant, but it took well over a century to extirpate this movement, which then retreated to, a shadow of its former self into Africa, or into northern Africa. From the experience of these past years, and the witness within the Islamic world, largely to the damage that these people have committed, have you seen the level of repugnance at their behavior and at what mainstream Islam considers distortion of their faith? Do you see that growing, and do you see a determination, even though Daesh can take advantage of the Shia Sunni split and local disaffections, generally do you see a growing repugnance and dissatisfaction to the point that they themselves are not going to allow these people to succeed again?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, the fighting done against Daesh was done by Muslims. Let's not forget that. It was done by Muslims, and it was done, by the Syrian Democratic Forces, and it was done by the Iraqi counterterrorism forces. One of the issues of Dabiq was devoted to they had a picture of the King of Saudi Arabia with a target on him on the cover, and basically it was in Catholic terms, it was an excommunication of the entire hierarchy of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states. So when you looked at the global anti-Daesh task force that was set up, task forces that were set up under U.S. domination, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, all of these countries played an important role in that, to include in the counter-financing mode. So when you have an organization that characterized 98% of the Muslim world as either apostates or schismatics, that's not a recipe for a broad base. Unfortunately, the attraction, because so much of the world is misgoverned, you saw that the greatest sources of foreign fighters was Tunisia on a per capita basis. And Tunisia, is viewed as until the recent coup was the only success of the Arab Spring. It's a secular republic. It's very closely, it's very westernized. So what it showed goes back to the counterinsurgency principle, the importance of good governance. I would argue that the persistence of corruption, particularly petty corruption, the having to pay off somebody to get your kid into school, not so much the corruption like you see in Nigeria, millions of dollars disappearing from the national oil company, but that petty corruption appears to, I think in my mind, is one of these major drivers of disaffection, which provides the fertile ground for the insurgency that in the 60s would have a communist tinge, but because communism has been so discredited in Muslim countries, it now has an Islamist tinge. But the real venom is directed towards other Muslims. And other Muslims have realized that. And I was talking to a group of military officers from a Muslim country, and I made the point. I said, look, if Daesh were to drop in here and take over, you'd all be beheaded as apostates. I'd just have to pay a tax. So, you guys are in trouble, not me. And there's a recognition of that. There's a recognition of that. Now, as always, when you're engaged in coalition warfare, and this is coalition warfare, every coalition member thinks every other coalition member isn't doing enough, isn't doing his share. But there is a recognition of the threat, I think.
Now, when I had the privilege of teaching some Muslim officers years ago at the same National Defense University, we were discussing this very issue in a class, and I was trying to lay out the ideology then, back then, of Al-Qaeda. And one of the more senior officers from an Arab country said, "We hate these people."
Yeah, that's right.
And I said, "But," I said, "Colonel, that's not good enough. You've got to both understand them and also, it's their ideology that's having an appeal. You have to be able to counter that ideology." And since, as you point out, there are many affiliates, I don't know how many today, there used to be, what, about 18 back in 7, 8 years ago. Are there more today or fewer or
Honestly,
whatever
I'd have
the
to look at a
count is?
map.
You have
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
yeah. Is the need for that war of ideas aspect and countering the appeal of Daesh still present in the Arabs of other Muslims, and are they engaging in it through their own media?
Good question. I think they are. The problem is, in many of these countries, these are not democratic countries. The positions are appointed. So you can talk to a leader and they'll say, yes, we had our leading theologians sign a letter that said, this is not Islam. This is not compatible with Islam. Daesh should be done. But the problem is, when you get down to the individual level, the person who's struggling, who thinks the game is rigged against him, who's dealing in a government that's highly corrupt, and who knows that the leaders who signed that letter are they're either put there by the government or they maintain their position with the acquiescence of the government, that reinforces the Daesh narrative. So what's required, and this is one of the points that our partners miss, the lack of democratic accountability. It's not just a Western fetish that we do out of foolish consistency because we want the rest of the world to look like us. We in the West actually believe that our form of government enhances national security. I mean, the United States and Canada, fought a war every 20 years from, you know, 1757, before the United States was formed, all the way up until about 1860. There were cross-border instances, really 1880, you know, Louis Riel. So that's 130 years of warfare, you know, between the United States and Canada, along a long border that's indefensible. You know, my parents are Canadian immigrants, and I was an officer in the United States Army. You know, how did we solve that? Well, a big part of it is both countries had democratic institutions and democratic systems of government that was responsible to the needs of its citizens, and this boiling over of grievances that should be dealt with by governance into violence, that just became unthinkable, it became stupid. You know, the idea of conflict between the United States and Canada, yeah, that's what the National Hockey League's for, right? Too many times when I talk to people in the Arab world, they think that I'm just projecting, you know, or that I have this foolish consistency. But this form of accountable government and effective government as a counterinsurgency theorist, whether we're talking about communists in Latin America, you know, or ethnic division in Africa, you know, Biafra, whatever, or whether we're talking about the Islamic State, effective government is the way to deal with it. And the greatest challenge and the least amount of traction I've had in my dealings in the region is trying to convince people of that as a security imperative, not as something to make the Americans happy. That's a challenge.
But of course, in a certain perspective, from one Islamic angle, it's precisely the kind of government that is representative democracy, which is itself haram.
Yes. So, I mean, one thing that drew a lot of people off, this was, we saw in London, where, you know, if you want to see really radicalized Muslims, you know, where I think in one of my talks I had the cover where the guy, you know, saying, you know, democracy can go to hell. Yeah. And so it's kind of like we're bringing a football bat to the game. And what's important is for people, you know, the Saudis and some other governments have made steps forward where they talk about consultation and the importance of shura as an Islamic concept of government. And, you know, and it is, I do take the point that, you know, if you go too quickly, you make the mistake we made in Bosnia or with the elections after the fall of Mubarak. You know, you have to take time to build institutions so that you get legitimate, so that you don't just give gangsters the veneer of democratic legitimacy, which is what we did in Bosnia. It's important to realize that reform and security are not two separate issues. They are related. You know, the dangers and the benefits from reform are seen in the much longer term, but they are real and they do exist.
And that's obviously something they have to do for themselves.
That's something they have to do for themselves. And reform is hard.
Successful trying to do it for them.
Well, you know, some would argue that we haven't put a whole lot of effort into it, that, you know, it's just been lip service and that, you know, a lot of compromises were made during the Cold War, but...
No, I mean, 20 years in Afghanistan,
the
long presence in Iraq, etc.
Yeah, that's right. The Iraq, I think, is a good example of, you know, what did we do? You know, we held elections which basically just divided the country on secular lines. And that proved to be dysfunctional. And that election led to a triumphalist mode, not a republic, small r republican mode of government where everybody has a basic level of guaranteed rights, but to democracy as two wolves and a sheep arguing over what's for lunch, where the people with the most said, okay, we're in charge, I am everything, you are nothing, you work for me, which bred the resentment, which led to the public, if not support, at least acquiescence for the rise of Daesh as an anti-Shia mechanism.
Well, we can point to Daesh affiliates in Mozambique and Niger, as you pointed out, these in other African countries. But from what you said, it would seem to me the point of greatest danger would be a resurgence within Iraq itself should the government fail to come to the realization of the various things you're talking about, that it can't just be two wolves fighting over who gets to eat the sheep.
Yeah, but honestly, I think I am hopeful for Iraq. Mm-hmm. I think people get it. I think
they've suffered enough. They've got to understand something.
Yeah. When we killed Qasem Soleimani, everybody overlooks the other guy in the car Abdulmadi al-Muhandis, who was the deputy commander of the popular militia, who I have argued his death was more significant than Qasem Soleimani. You kill the leader of the Quds force, there will be another leader of the Quds force. He may be more effective, he may be less effective, but he will be replaced, and he'll have the weight of the Iranian state behind him. Abdulmadi al-Muhandis was irreplaceable. He was an Iraqi who faithfully served the Iranian state and the interests of the Iranian state, more faithfully than most Iranians, and had embedded himself into a position of authority and influence within the Iraqi security apparatus. And up to that point, we, the United States, had engaged in some sort of self-restraint where if a person had acquired the veneer of a national position, he was hands off. And so I think that kind of showed that no. The Iraqi state, to be effective, is going to have to represent Iraqi security interests. So I'm kind of hoping that both a common realization that, look, this happened once, we don't want it to happen again, as well as removing a few key bad actors from the screen, will prevent this from getting too serious.
Well, Dave, in light of everything you have said, you mentioned earlier that our attention and the attention of Europe and other parts of the world have been deflected by the war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Has it been deflected to the extent that Europe is no longer addressing itself to the problems that the Islamic State presents? And is the United States remaining focused on this as a real and perhaps growing danger? And if not, what should the policy be?
Well, good question. So the Iraqi government is focused on this. The Syrian government, of course, is not. And the Syrian government, I would argue, for Bashar al-Assad's legitimacy, it serves his purposes for him to maintain control of the Syrie utile, everything from Aleppo down to Damascus, west of that. He has that. The east doesn't really matter. And as long as there's an active insurgency there, he can present himself as the bulwark of civilization against this barbaric violence. And his Russian patrons, until they run out of money, and they're starting to realize that the money that went down that Syrian rat hole, those billions, they're never going to see again. So they're starting to get a little nervous about that. So that's going to be a problem. But on the Iraqi side of the border, I'm actually sanguine that they've recognized the mistake they've made. I think that, oddly enough, I thought I'd never say this, but, Muqtada al-Sadr, a man who spent a lot of time hiding out in Iran from the United States, seems to have recognized that the interests of Iraq are not the same thing as the interests of Iran. And, hopefully, the conditions that gave birth to Daesh in Iraq, those will not be replicated. The bigger question is, I don't think Obama, Trump, or Biden has a strategic plan for Syria. I don't think they have an idea of what they want to do. The American presence in Syria is there to prevent bad things from happening, and you can list them all off. But keeping bad things from happening is not a strategy. And this is a bipartisan failure over three administrations. And the question is, how long can the Syrian Democratic Forces, soi-disant, how long can they maintain rule until the local population turns against them?
Outside the question of Syria, Art, we're going to make you double-hatted Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense.
Well, both of my classmates have held that position at the same time.
So what is your, what policy would you formulate to address the Islamic State problem today?
A good question. I think the first thing I would do is internationalize the problem of the detainees who can't return. Honestly, our partners have buried their head in the sand on this, and we can't allow that to happen. So, it may be something like British internment, where they took people and put them on an island in the Indian Ocean or something, but there has to be something better than just this chaos, criminal activity, prostitution, you know, desperate people trying to survive. And the only people who have money are people who support ISIS, because ISIS funds money to them. And so people who want to break from this can't get out. There's no way for them to get out, and they don't have any money. So they have to do things that they don't want to do, that's not in our interest. And we're raising a generation of radicalized children. No good will come of that. So that's the first thing. And I don't know if it's, you know, you take, you know, an island in the South Pacific or something, and start to separate people out. You know, we've never been good at that, but you know, we can't just roll over and find the cool side of the pillow and hope that that problem goes away. The second thing I'd look at is there really needs to be a comprehensive discussion of what it is we want to do with Syria. We have most of our anti-ISIS measure in Syria has been through the Syrian Democratic Forces. And, you know, either they need to, you know, we need to come to an accommodation as to how they are going to govern, how they're going to fund themselves, and how we're going to support them, and the ways they're going to conduct. So far, that's worked remarkably well. But, you know, you get a bad leader in there, and, you know, the West, you know, doesn't support things when you get bad optics. So I think we need to build something institutional, you know, institutionalize it one way or the other. And if it becomes a semi-autonomous region like the Kurdish region of Iraq does, okay, so do it. But let's do it as a result of planning and calculations and weighing risks instead of just organizational inertia, what engineers call scabbing onto the design. Let's do it by design instead of scabbing. That's the second thing. And then finally, I think that we do need to look at how, and this is something I wrote on at the Army War College, it didn't go over well, but one of the most disturbing characteristics of the rise of Daesh for those of us in the West were the number of, not so much immigrants as children of immigrants to the West who proved to be supporters of ISIS. And I think there needs to be a comprehensive examination of how people who move to countries in the West become citizens of that country. And I think a lot of this has been assumptions that, you know, well, you know, that were valid in the days when it took 3 months to get from Europe to the United States by sailing ship, you know, and you weren't going to just casually go back, and you couldn't, you know, you maybe read a newspaper once a month, but now you have constant television and foreign language. I think we need to have a discussion about what citizenship means in the modern world, how people acquire it, what its obligations are, and how we ensure that citizenship doesn't just become a license to propagate primordialism. And, you know, I mean, you know, I'm a Montreal Canadiens fan who was raised in Los Angeles, okay? So I know how strong the pull of primordialism is. But I think that's something we need to look at, because quite frankly, these things are based on historical accident, and technology has nullified that. So I think we need to have an honest discussion about that, because that's really, I think, what really shocked people more than anything else, at least in this part of the world. Does that make sense?
It does. I recall a short story from Great Britain, My Son the Islamist, or My Son the Radical. A London cab driver who is first generation, I forget, Pakistani, or, can't figure out why his son is being radicalized and why he's choosing this super austere way of life, and why he so dislikes Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And he says to his son, I don't get this. Don't you understand? You can do anything here. And his son responds, I know. That's the problem. Well, so there was that, that certain sort of, an aimlessness that in the youth's life that is solved by the appeal of the radical Islamist ideology.
Yeah, or any kind of, you know, when you look at radicalization of anything, if you look at, you know, the Weather Underground in the 70s, you know, I mean, I've always said that a lot of people that support Islamic State, you know, 30 years ago would have been communists, you know, or they would have been Red Brigades,
right,
or Aldo Moro. This is a condition of human nature. It's not really a problem with Islam. Islam is the framework that is being looked at now because socialism and communism are discredited. And before that, it was anarchism. And, you know, as long as you have a dominant world order and people who lose out from that dominant order, you know, it's liberalism and its discontents. As long as you have that, those people who feel left out or feel lost or adrift are going to seek some sort of organizing principle, and a certain small percentage of them are going to be violent. This is just the nature of humanity, I think. And unfortunately, some people are dogs who like to run around. Some people are rabbits who want to go into a dark place and feel the walls.
It's interesting that it's the second generation, because what you often find, and this is true in this country, as you know, a lot of Muslims, as do I, when I've asked about this question, you know, aren't you worried about the, and I say, no, you don't understand that the Muslims who come to this country are usually leaving a country that's in a highly dysfunctional state, sometimes because of the particular brand of Islam that that state is imposing, and they don't come to the United States to replicate the dysfunction from which they're fleeing. So that's the first generation. By the time you get to the second generation, if they don't find any direction in their life, they could become a Montreal hockey fan. No, I'm just, you know, they could revert and say, no, it must be back there, the direction of my life. Well, anyway, any closing comment?
Well, I want to bring back to the base principles of counterinsurgency, which is my first love, which is, this is all a function of governance. People focus on the religious veneer, and then they get an argument over religion, something like that. At the end of the day, it comes down to governance. And if you have effective governance, you don't have this kind of problems. And if you have ineffective governance, and that can take many forms, and it can be a place that's otherwise perfect, but there's a specific beef, then you have problems. So look at governance first. And the veneer and the facade is not as important as governance. And this idea that somehow governance is different from security, that is the cardinal error, the cardinal error.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time right now, and I would like to thank our guest, Dave DeRoche from the National Defense University, for joining us today to discuss the Islamic State today. I invite you to go to the Westminster Institute website and to our YouTube page to see what other offerings we have on other subjects such as Ukraine, Russia, China, and also to Dave DeRoche's earlier programs that he has done with us that I mentioned at the beginning of the program. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bob Riley.